keeping those stats and being almost like detached from the result a little bit of like, okay, what did I have? Where did I hit it? What club did I, you know, writing those things almost like, all right, that shot is done. It's now in the past and I can go and move on to the next one. It's keep your stats, know what to work on, find somebody that knows your swing that you can send them videos or see them once or twice or, you know, whatever the frequency is. But, and then probably for the most part, like once you get to a certain level, like you don't need to overhaul stuff usually.
Yeah.
Like you call it kind of the disease of more, where it's always like, okay, I had this, but now what if I, what if I do this?
I know. Or there.
And most of the time it probably doesn't need that. It's just like, all right, just kind of make a plan and keep sticking to it. And then you'll see it year over year of improvement.
There is a podcast brewing that's about to take over podcasting for good. The only podcast that you are going to need to tune into day in, day out is the Member Guest Podcast.
If I can hit it down the middle of the fairway, that's great. But again, with the driver right now, the driver sucks.
John Daly, and you're listening to the Member Guest Podcast. Rip it.
Bennett, welcome to the studio. How do I pronounce your last name?
Smead. It looks like Smed.
It looks like Smed.
Yes.
But I could have swore somebody said Smead once, and I was like, I couldn't tell if they were serious or not.
Yeah, no, so. You can call me whatever you want. I'm sure.
S-M-E-D, but it's Smead.
Yep. I've heard worse, I promise. So people add like S-H's in there and go Schmead or Schmed sometimes.
Schmeds.
Yeah. So, you know.
What does everybody at the yacht club call you?
Ooh. I think it's just like I've lost my first name now. It's just Smead.
They just call you Smead?
Yeah.
That's nice. So, that's a good nickname.
I'm good. That was what they called me in high school too. So I was all good with it.
Smead's a good like last name for a nickname too. Like mine's kind of just Hagel. Like it's fine, but like Smead's, that's a good, name.
It works. It's the only one I got. So I might as well run with it.
I'll call you Smead.
That's cool.
Is technically your title head pro at the, or not head pro, like head teaching professional?
Director of instruction
at the Wiper Yacht Club.
Yeah. So just finishing up my second year now there. So, it's gone quick, but it's been awesome. So.
I actually coincidentally have the Dunning guys coming this evening, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of the stuff they're doing over your guys' course.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Because you guys just redid the whole short game area. You're currently redoing it?
Yep. So we opened a short game area this spring. So it opened kind of mid-late May. So basically it's directly down off the first tee, and that that area used to be all trees, which like I didn't even know we owned that area. I thought it was just all private land or whatever, but we, you know, being an older golf course, we were pretty constrained on space. So we were like, okay, we could use this. You can basically hit any shot inside of 45, 50 yards. Cause our range is a little bit smaller. Our putting green is smaller. So we needed somewhere for people to actually be able to practice short game. And it's been really awesome. And Jim Urbina, who's kind of our architect on retainer, essentially. So he kind of comes out, and anytime we want to update something to the master plan or whatever, he'll come out and help us consult with that. He kind of helped design it, and it's been great.
Yeah, you guys kind of, I don't want to say got to keep up with the times, right? But it seems like a lot of courses are going through a lot of redesign and effort. Like totally. I know Wyzetta, obviously Interlock, and just did their big deal. And I'm always curious because like you guys are consistently, if not in the top 100, like right outside the Golf Digest top 100, somewhere always right in there. And so people always, when they see Minnesota, they always go, oh, have you ever played Wiper Yacht Club? I'm like, yeah, I've played there before. And so is there like, I don't want to too many secrets, but like, is there more that's going to be coming and changing over the years? Or is it always just continual tweaks to what is already widely acknowledged as a top 100 course? Or what's the master plan you refer to?
I would say more so the kind of little tweaks. The project that we're currently just kind of wrapping up as we speak, I think Dunnick has all their machines kind of off property now. So we did starting basically the Monday after July 4th of this year, we did an entirely new irrigation and drainage system, which is a big project. It's just also a big project that you bury in the ground and like the members don't see it like on a day-to-day basis. Yeah. So like, not that it was a tough sell to the members, because like our drainage system was infinitely overdue for a new, you know, an overhaul. But it was like, okay, cool, this is, you know, going to cost X amount of money, and then we're going to bury it in the ground, and you're not going to, it's not a shiny new toy that they can walk past every day. So like it passed easily as far as like the vote goes and stuff, but it was also like, okay, nobody really knew what to expect. We were going to close. We closed like 3 to 4 holes at a time instead of just doing all net, like the front nine all at once, sure, back nine all at once, that kind of thing. So we started July 8th. Basically, if you've ever been on property, I know you have, but the listeners on at the yacht club, there's literally a 2-lane road that bisects the front nine and the back nine, essentially. So we started across the road on the back nine, closed 3 or 4 holes back there, and then just kind of worked our way back toward the clubhouse, essentially. So right now they're finishing up 2, 3, and 4 are the last couple holes, and then they're all done. So the main line irrigation was the big thing. And then as holes were closed, we did some green expansions, put some bunkers back that used to be there that weren't anymore, that kind of stuff. So just touched it up. But I think going forward, this project handled a lot of our like master plan for the next however many years. So then from now on, from here on out, for the foreseeable future, it'll just be touch ups.
And you said you've been there 2 years now. So where were you before, if anywhere?
Yeah. So I was, I started in the golf business in 2017. I was, played college golf at Bethel in St. Paul. And then my wife is from Brainerd. So after college, I started just kind of as a do everything assistant up at Grandview. I was at the Pines, kind of like a here's your first golf job, see what takes, you know, kind of do everything. So I was in the shop, kind of helping with tournaments, did some teaching and that kind of stuff, and then really gravitated toward the teaching and coaching. And then obviously I play a pretty full schedule as well. So was at Grandview for 2 years and then took the head teaching pro job at the Classic at Madden's. So I ran all the instruction at Madden's for just about 5 years. And then, have known Chris, the GM at the yacht club, for a long time, just through the business and stuff. So we were just randomly talking and he was like, hey, like, are you guys any interest in coming back down to the cities? And, you know, we're like, well, how do you know what you're saying no to unless you have the conversation and see what it's like? So then, number of conversations later, we were on our way back to, you know, down to White Bear. So, yeah. Moved down
my hometown, go Bears.
That's right. So started there kind of March 1st of 23 and now we're completing year 2, which is wild how fast it goes.
It's awesome. It is crazy how fast it goes. I was just thinking the other day about how I've been at Windsong now 3 years, and you and I were just talking before this that we'll be coming up on 4 years living in this house. And I think our 2-year anniversary of the pod is probably like right around right now. I think we started around Thanksgiving 2 years ago and we're going to be at 100 episodes, I think, before end of the year, which it's crazy how fast time flies. Like older you get to, that's what everybody says. The older you get, the faster it goes. So
No, it's really cool.
I did not want to cut you off when we were talking before this, but you, saw the yacht club flag and, then it all kind of clicked that, so you played in the scratch golf, season long deal that we did between, I believe it's, Windsong, Woodhill, you guys, Edina.
Yep. I think just those four, right?
Is it just those four?
I think so.
Is that what it was?
Yep.
Edina took it home this year, but it was my first time playing that, which I didn't realize, like, it's some pretty good competitive golf at like really good courses around the state too. It's pretty sweet.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a good, I think they've been doing it now for, I think this was maybe the 3rd or 4th year they've been doing it. So they kind of, the way that Scratch Match kind of started was each course will host, you know, one in June, one in July, one in September, one in October or August or whatever. And then it's basically one pro and you bring 3 AMs, you know, or 4 AMs or whatever it is. And then it's a 2-person best ball. So we have a pretty big professional staff at the yacht club. So we try to send a different pro to each site basically. And we're like, hey, who wants to go play, you know, Eddie Dyna this year, who wants to go play Windsong? I did not play our home one at the yacht club. But you got paired with some of our fun members.
Yep. Too.
Charlie and Dave. Awesome. And I walked in kind of, I don't know, it was probably around lunchtime or something. I was done teaching and somebody came up and they were like, hey, one of the Windsong guys shot 29 on the front. And I was like, oh, okay. Like now we got something to pay attention to here on the back nine, which is pretty exciting. But, Dave, our member came up and he was like, yeah, Jordan is unconscious right now. And he's like, doesn't even know what he shot, which is crazy. But
yeah, I wish I didn't know what I shot coming off the nine. Cause that's when it all, so, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about tournament golf and obviously a lot of that has to do with mindset too. But the reason that, round was special to me was one, like, you know, I had shot under par a couple times, but we're talking like one or two under par, like nothing really serious. And I think it was quite literally the day before that round at Yacht Club. I shot like a 79 in the USAM qualifier at Dakota Ridge. I didn't play necessarily bad. I actually thought I hit it pretty good. I had an unfortunate lost ball on hole one, which was my hole 10. I literally drove the ball in the rough and we never found it. Like definitely not out of bounds. You know, just like bad deep
luck.
Rough.
Yeah.
Bad luck. Never found it. I had to re-tee, ended up making like an eight, which normally would have just been a bogey, but I was kind of rushing. Like my guys were already on the next tee waiting for me. And I'm just like frantic. And the next day I show up and in that mindset of like, man, I just played really bad. I got no expectations. Let's just go out and have fun. And I didn't know where I was. In hindsight, like I birdied one, parred two, hit it to a foot on three, which I believe is the par three. And then yep. I birdied all the other holes except for the two par fives. So what, hole like four and six maybe?
Yep. 4, 7, and 9 are all par
fives. So 4 and 7, I actually parred, hitting it either on or around the green in two, and all the other ones I had birdied up until hole 9, which I eagled. So I parred, was that holes 2, 4, and 6.
Yep.
And then the other six, I was 7 under. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
5 birdies and an eagle. Yeah. So 7 under.
Pretty good. Yeah.
And, I eagled 9 and whatever the member in our group yelled, that's an expletive.
Yes.
That's a fucking 29.
Yeah.
And like, you know how hole 9 is at Yacht Club. You are literally like on the patio where people are eating. You're also right
people.
Next
yeah.
to hole 1 where people are teeing off. There's a bunch of people there and all of a sudden, like I look like a deer in the headlights. I mean, like everyone's looking at me. Everyone's like, oh, go shoot the course record on the bat. Like,
yeah.
And I kind of freaked out. So we get the hole 10. I pipe my drive and I'm not exaggerating. I hit a ball to about 3 feet, right above the hole. So like the hole, it's a very, if I remember front to back, right. And I ended up being above the hole.
Yep.
And I looked like Rory at the US Open or whatever tournament it was where
yeah,
I was
just
hitting
shaking
like,
it in there. Yep.
Yeah, I've got like a 3 footer that I have to play 2 cups outside the hole. I miss it. Next hole is a par 3. I almost make it. Like I hit it to another tap in. So now I'm like, okay, we're fine. We're back. And then to what you just said, the hole with the road over it.
Yep, 12.
So 12, you're literally, for people that have never played Wiper Yacht Club, you're standing on a tee box and there is an active road, I don't know, what do you think, 30 feet from you?
Like if a FedEx truck like drove on the road in front of your tee shot, you'd be like in the guy's cockpit, basically. Like
I'd say you
probably have 10 feet till
the
road
starts.
Yeah,
maybe it's 10 feet. And you're elevated, obviously, right?
Bit.
Like you're not like on the shoulder of the road.
Right.
But you're very close to it. And so we're waiting. The guys are like, you seem to wait till you don't hear anything. And so you don't hear a car. And so I wait, kind of step up and go through my routine, step back so I hear a car, go up again. And then like right as I'm about to start to go, I hear a car and I'm like, fuck, I got to go. And then I snap it left. I end up making a bogey. And I think I parred every other hole out from there, except for 18. I tried to jam home a birdie and cause I knew I couldn't get it anymore, but
right.
it was,
so still an awesome
it was
round,
crazy.
But it's, and like that tee shot specifically is super, like number 12 is super uncomfortable because of the road. And then it was actually more uncomfortable up until about a year ago because you couldn't see the fairway from those tees because there were about head high shrubs kind of immediately on the other side of the road.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, okay, one, there's a, you know, if a semi truck comes here, it's coming back at me essentially. Yeah. Right. And then,
and the power lines,
you
can hit the power
and
lines.
I don't know where to go. Yeah. It's like, that's one of those holes that gives White Bear its charm, but it's like, also if you built that today, you'd probably get fired.
Yeah.
Right. Where it's like, you know, if a modern Gil Hance or somebody like came in and was like, yeah, I think we should build a tee box like across the road. It'd be like, here's your money back. Go away. But like, you know, Mr. Ross in, 1920 was like, this would be sweet. And they didn't have the machinery to do anything else about it. So that's just where it was. But
yeah, which is fine. And in hindsight, I wish I could go do that back 9 over again. Right. But like you can't, but also it'll always be a special place in my heart. Cause it was like the first time I had really shot under par, like, where I was deep and I played a whole back 9, knowing that I could shoot my, best. And obviously there's other stuff at play, but like, It was cool. So I wish I would have met you that day. We could have set this up a lot sooner.
We could have
talked about the mental side of this, which we still had some season left.
Right.
Yeah. Because I know, so you play, like you said, a full tournament year of golf in Minnesota. And so I think I had, his name's Harry Ollington. If you know Harry, by any chance, on a couple weeks ago, he just qualified for the US four ball with, Drew Bosley. And, he does a pretty full tournament scheduled too. And so I'm curious, you know, as I'm starting to play more tournaments, I play like the mid-am every year and that's about it for Minnesota, maybe like a qualifier or two.
Yeah.
What's the full tournament schedule, in Minnesota look like? Like what's it consist of and what are the goals for you?
Yeah. So for us, you know, it's kind of when people ask about like my tournament specifically, but just kind of how this stuff like works is, so as a PGA professional, you know, so, guy that's working that also plays, right? I wouldn't say I'm a full-time professional golfer, right? I'm not, not playing for my living, right? I'm teaching, sure. You know, full-time teacher, play, great way to supplement your income if you play well,
yeah.
Right? And you can qualify for stuff and all that stuff. So the Minnesota PGA runs a really awesome section schedule. So, we have anything from one-day pro-ams to, you know, where, if Winsong wanted to host a section pro-am, they would find a date. They basically just set it up themselves, make sure the purse conforms to the section. You know, we have some parameters and stuff. And then it can either be an open pro-am or an invite where if Kleinbrook was like, hey, I only want it to be invite. Great. Or anybody that can bring
kind of like
team.
A tape mark
a little bit. Yeah. A little bit. So we have,
it's not the tape mark anymore. I don't think, but
yeah, right. So that's like, the artist formerly known as the Tape Mark is kind of what, that's one of our big kind of section majors, state open, Minnesota Golf Champions. We have a big section match play every year. So those are kind of our big like point events. And then the Minnesota PGA Professional Championship. So our section championship, which will determine who goes to the national PGA in the spring. And then from there, if you qualify for the National Club Pro, the top 20 from that tournament qualify for the PGA Championship. So that's, kind of a big carrot for us is like,
and all your stuff. So it's all, teaching professionals.
Nope. So just any, so head pros,
or I guess head pros,
assistant pros,
but not just professional golfers that live in Minnesota. They've got to be,
which some of our, so like state open tape mark, they can play in those, golf champions, is another one in the fall. So, but as far as like state or, our section championship, the match play, some of our other like pro only events, and then some of the pro-ams, those are mostly section pros.
Okay.
So I do a pretty full schedule of those. I'll probably end up this year, I think I played right about 25 events.
Oh wow.
Yeah. So it's a pretty full schedule. There are some guys in the section that'll play close to 30, not many, but, and then, so the big carrots for us would be qualifying, you know, the section championship at the end of August is a big one. Cause that, like I said, determines who goes to the National Club Pro. Our player of the year for the section gets a spot in the 3M every summer, which is a big one.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So that, I assume that's going to continue going forward. I don't know what the partnership looks like between the section and the 3M, but that's how it's been in the past. And then the state open champ gets a spot in the Canadian Tour event in Brainerd, the one at Craigens. And then we also have a separate like points list thing for just section pros that the top guy from that also gets a spot in the CRMC, the Brainerd event. So there's a few different ways to kind of qualify up essentially.
Yeah.
But I could go, you know, I could go do Q school or go play a Dakota's Tour event or whatever. Like it's just as much of like a professional as far as classification goes.
Sure.
I just, you know, happen to also teach full time.
Yeah. So, you play in any of the other, or like, is that everything? Like, are there events that you could play in that you don't, or I guess vice versa?
Yeah. I mean, like I certainly could go, kind of the ones, so we have a couple sections we'll give Minnesota pros like reciprocity into their state opens. So like, the Iowa State Open, Nebraska, I know a couple people go play in that one where they give you essentially like the same pricing as a Nebraska pro would get as far as entry fees, which like makes it, you know, can save you a couple hundred bucks on the entry fee or whatever. But I could go do Dakota Tour or could qualify for Q school or, you know, try to go through Q school and stuff. I haven't ever done that. It's, you know,
and I mean, for you, like, what is it? What's it for? Is it to scratch the competitive itch? Is it, You know, like what's the reasoning behind? Because you certainly wouldn't have to.
No, definitely.
But clearly you do a lot. So there's got to be a reason that you do it.
Yeah, definitely. The competitive side of it is huge. Just keeping my game sharp. I think the biggest kind of underlying thing is I love it. I love just playing competitive golf. Cause like the more tournaments or the more years of tournaments that I've played, like it's so much easier to just not care about casual golf. Like if we just go out and it's like, oh, you shot, like, it doesn't matter really. If just going to play, it's like, oh, I shot 42 on the front. Like, you know, whatever. Like,
yeah,
that's fine. But then like tournament golf, and I'm sure we'll talk about it. Like tournament golf is just so different. Like when you're under the gun and like, you're kind of, you know, there's pressure and it's like, oh, you got to finish out all these three footers. And like, you know, you actually, it's just a different beast. And then, but I think the big carrots for me would be, you know, going to the National Club Pro, it's at some point, hopefully trying to play in a PGA Championship. Player of the year for a section is a big one. I was third this year. So
who do you finish behind?
Thomas Campbell was he won the player of the year this year. He had a really awesome, super consistent year. So he had a decent gap. And then Jeff Sorensen from Minnetonka was second. And
I've seen those names.
Yep.
I don't know him personally.
Yeah. But. Jeff Sorney teaches at Minnetonka. And then I was third. I think Sorney got me by like 6 points or something. So like I was, you know, right there.
Yeah.
And I would say a pretty solid year. Like I think one thing that's helped keep me motivated and going is like, especially over the last 4 or 5 years, I've noticed like very clear and significant jumps in my game as far as improvement goes. So like whether that's the easy metrics of like, did you win more money than you did last year? Does your scoring average come down like that? Like those are either the very clear like yes or no's, which thankfully both of those have been yes for me over the last few years, which is great. But then it's like, do you feel more comfortable under pressure? Are you starting to get yourself in contention more, like that kind of stuff? So like, I mean, I was right there in the State Open this year on the, you know, kind of starting the back nine. I made a couple bogeys in the back nine to kind of fall out of it. But that was a big step. And I think one thing, like my theme of the year for me, like competitively this year was like, I want to try to get uncomfortable as much as possible. So like just get in contention and see what happens. And you might fall miserably on your face, or it might work out, you know? And it's like, but as long as you're like putting yourself in, you know, putting yourself there, then you know the stuff you're doing out, you know.
Yeah, you're doing something right to get there in the first place, right?
Mm-hmm.
I had John Ellis on, it would have been this most recent episode, but it was maybe like a week and a half ago. And I talked to him a pretty decent amount because I think he appreciates like where I'm trying to get with my game. And he's always got like the best insights because obviously he's, one, played at the highest level, but two, he like sees the highest level every week out on the bag for Wyndham and sees all those guys. And he was like, yeah, I'll help you write down some, you know, some goals for next year. Because I was telling him what I thought they should be. And I brought up one scoring average like you did. Like that seems like an easy one to track. And then the second, I think it was, God, I can't even remember what it was now, but the way that he framed it was like, you need to stop tracking that. You need to start tracking how many bogeys you make from inside 150 when you're inside 150.
Yep, totally.
Or you need to start like just tracking different metrics that will obviously correlate to what eventually is your broader goal, but you have to start tracking them a different way and thinking of the game in a different way. And I'd quite frankly never thought of it from 100%. That perspective.
Yep. Yeah, because like the scoring average thing, it's a big, easy, you know, you can put it on the wall. It's like your 2023 scoring average was X, your 2024 scoring average was Y. Did it go down or did it not? But there's so many things that go into that, right? It's like, okay, well, did I stop making bogeys inside of 150 yards? That's one. Like, did I think par three performance for like, if we're talking just
now, my par three scoring is horrible.
Now just shifting into like my teaching mind is like, if you know, I tell people this all the time in lessons is like, if you can just aim to make a three, if you make a three on every par three for the rest of your life, you'd be ecstatic and you would,
yeah, you take it right there.
100%.
You take it and run.
And it's like, that's all the, you know, just in middle of the green sounds really cliche, but it's like smart targets. And I know you've had Fawcett on, and like, so I'm a big subscriber to the decade stuff. Cause I think it makes a lot of sense. But it's like, okay, improve your par three performance. get the ball and play off the tee, make your tee, you know, make your tee shots as boring as possible. Yeah. Right.
One and shot then, shape.
Exactly. Day. And it's like clean up the three putts, right? It's like not, you know, 50% make percentage on the PGA Tour is like 8 feet, 2 inches. So it's like, all right, if the best players in the world are only making 50% of their 8 footers, it's like, why are we getting upset about missing like 15, 18 footers? Right.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, just if I prescribe somebody to practice anything with their putting, it's get really, really good inside 6 feet and get really, really good outside of 30.
Yeah.
Right. Cause everything else, in between there will kind of take care of itself over the course of the season. Right. So it's like, all right, if you're making your shorties and you can two putt from 35 feet, it's like, you're not going to get in trouble that much, which is super easier said than done. But at the same time, it's a great thing to focus on.
Yeah. Since you're a decade golf guy, I've really, you know, so I tried to do it this past year and then I realized, man, this is way harder to actually do than like, you know, actually the physical part of writing everything down, remembering it, putting in the actual scores and everything. That's the hard part. The doing it, I think, on the course isn't that difficult, but then actually writing everything down, that's the hard part. And so I wanted to commit to it this year. Then I didn't, as much as I would have liked, but my last like 5 rounds, I really dig. So I'm like, I need to know what I want to work on or what I need to work on in the off season. And, I looked at my putting stats and they're actually not that bad. Like I've always thought that I need to be a better putter inside of, you know, call it 30 feet when like the reality is my putting strokes. I mean, my make rate from 11 to 15 is 40%. My make rate between 3 and 4 feet is over 90%. Like it's green, right? My 3-putt avoidance actually pretty solid. And really so good. Then I went and I looked at my, you know, I'm like, okay, well, where am I losing stuff? My short game, my save percentage is 25%.
Around the greens you're talking?
Yeah. Around the greens. Yep. Rough save percent, only 20. Sand save percent, 33%. Fairway save percent, only 50%. Like everything is red when it comes to short game. And then I started to look at my actual like approach into greens because I want to see, am I hitting it close enough? And I'm not. Like my wedges aren't getting close enough. I'm hitting the greens, but they're like 30 feet. And so John was saying like, you need to be hitting wedges inside of 20 feet. Mm-hmm. And like, it doesn't seem like that big of a difference. And then when you look at your putting, right, like you said, the chances that you're going to make a 20 footer are significantly better than making a 30 footer.
Right.
And so like, I'm trying to change my entire approach of how I look at practice and stats and all of it. And it sounds like you've already got like,
yeah. And I think that's
start on this.
I think it's, and this was the first year that I, kind of also like the same thing you were talking about, like really dove into the decade stuff as far as like trying to stat track and write it down. And one thing I found really helpful was, the keeping it on the course as far as like writing down, you know, how far you had into the green, what club you hit, where the flag was, all that stuff. It almost became like a bit of a, like a post shot routine for me. Like I would have it, you know, if you get a pin sheet or whatever. So I kind of keep it, you know, if I have 150 into a green, I'll mark where the flag is. I'll mark yardage, what a club. And then I try to do that after the shot a little bit, because then it helps me. I found maybe kind of an unintended consequence was that it helped me like almost conclude the shot I just hit instead of like taking it with me to the next shot, you know? So it's like, if I don't know, say I dump it in the bunker or something from 150 yards, like normally you're pissed, you slam your club in the bag, you jump in the cart or you push the push cart or whatever. Yeah. And then you're still fuming on it. But keeping those stats and being almost like detached from the result a little bit of like, okay, what did I have? Where did I hit it? What club did I, you know, writing those things almost like, all right, that shot is done. It's now in the past and I can go and move on to the next one. So I think it almost like, as somebody whose biggest kind of thing that's held me back in the competitive space that I think I've really improved on, but is the mental side of it, was like, oh, that's very helpful to be like, okay, I'm going to write down what happened and then it's done. And then I can go. And then afterwards, when I'm typing it all into the computer and stuff, then you can start to reflect and like, be like, okay, why did I dump into the bunker? Or like, if I shot whatever, 74, did I do that because I didn't make enough birdies or because I was silly and made some
I love how 74
sloppy.
Is gross to you. Well, I wish that was
okay. Well, you know, insert your number, right?
Just 74. Yeah, gosh.
Right.
But yeah, that's it's probably a 78 or 9 for for me.
But then you've seen your, as we look at that scorecard from the Yacht Club, your good is very good. Right. Yeah. So it's okay, how do we make that variance just smaller? Right. Yeah. Cause it's for us at the section professional level, or even if you're trying to play, full time for your living, it's you're trying to cut half shots off your game, which is wild. And it causes people to quit playing which is the most insane thing in the world. Cause they're the top, even the guys that are struggling on the Dakotas tour or whatever are they're so good at golf.
Yeah.
Right. But a lot of them will quit, or they won't make it because it's all right, you shot 71 instead of 69. It's that's wild.
Yeah.
So having some form of system of being all right, how do I accurately, cause you could spend all winter in here working on your putting stroke, thinking you don't make enough putts when it's actually your short game that needs work. Right. So that's where having, whether it's Decade or something else, having a really objective way to look at what you need to improve on is very, very helpful.
Well, when you put it that way, it is interesting. It's probably no coincidence that the one thing I can't really practice indoors is the worst part of my game, right? It's really hard to simulate chipping and bunker play in a simulator in the winter. It just is. But I was hoping I could pull this up. Let's see if I can find it. This guy was, do you follow the Monday Q guy on Twitter?
I do. Yeah.
Monday Qualifier Golf. I need to find it because he was just making a point that this kid at Q school. Oh, here we go. He shot an average. He never shot any rounds under par. And I think was here you go. First stage in Alabama, made 17 birdies. Only 5 bogeys, no doubles. Every round was under par, finished 14 under, and didn't get through the first stage of Q school.
Yeah, thanks for your donation.
Yeah, had to pay
couple grand.
Few grand, thanks, travel,
thanks
expense.
Thanks for showing up. Yep.
No rounds under par, 14 under, 17 birds, and didn't get through.
Yeah, it's crazy. And those are and that's just first stage, right? And then they got to condense the whole field to go to second and then to finals. And
his follow-up is, for the course was easy, guys out there. Par 72, playing it over 7,200 yards, course rating of 75, slope of 143.
Yeah.
Par threes were averaging 207 yards.
Yeah.
Off the tee, par fours were average 420, par fives were 550.
Yeah. What'd you say the rating was? 75 something?
74.7.
Yeah. I think Hazeltine from the back tees is 76. Yeah. Something like that. So
it's
maybe
a stroke easier than what pros play.
Yeah.
And he was four rounds under par and didn't even make it through the first.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, that's where that's, an extreme example of margins, right? And whether it's a guy trying to win their club championship or somebody trying to make, to break 90 for the first time, right? We all have margins. It's just how, what do you do to try to crack whatever, threshold you're trying to get to? And I think it was probably super beneficial for you to, when you were at the Yacht Club to be sitting there for a number of holes being 5-6 under par instead of just being, one or two or something like that.
Yeah.
A really good analogy that I've heard about and where we all kind of try to get to is PGA Tour players or guys that are just super comfortable going deep are like scuba divers where they've got the air tank and whatever, and they can dive and they can just keep going down. They can keep going deeper and deeper and deeper. And when you're used to being two under at one point and then you go back to level, that's like being a snorkeler, right? You're snorkeling
for a year,
right? Like a little bit of under the surface, and then your snorkel fills up with water and you have to go back up to the surface. Right. And so that's always stuck with me of how do we be more like scuba divers, or how do we get more comfortable doing that? And there's no magic bullet, right? It's little bits. It's kind of, the cliche, the 1% better every day thing, right? It's keep your stats, know what to work on, find somebody that knows your swing to, you can send them videos or see them once or twice, or, whatever the frequency is. But, and then probably for the most part, once you get to a certain level, you don't need to overhaul stuff usually.
Yeah.
You call it kind of the disease of more, where it's always okay, I had this, but now what if I
overhaul that?
What if I do this?
Better here,
I know.
Or there.
And most of the time it probably doesn't need that. It's just like, all right, just kind of make a plan and keep sticking to it. And then you'll see it year over year of improvement. But
how do we be more of a scuba diver and not a snorkeler? Cause I was a snorkeler for a year and I'm also admittedly a tinkerer of a lot of my clubs, equipment, and to, I guess, partially defend myself. I would say I'm still relatively new to the sport. Yeah. I mean, I didn't play in high school. I didn't play like anything really growing up. I was like anybody else. I had a set of clubs, dusted them off once or twice a year. And then like towards the end of college, caught the bug a little bit. Like you need to find a hobby. And then after college, that's when I started playing. I joined, you know, a country club, Southview. Gosh, that was probably 5 years ago because I was there 2 years before Wintong. Now in Wintong, 3 years. So like really got into the sport, I would say 7 years ago. And I never understood like all the intricacies between equipment and shafts and like getting fit and all that stuff. And then when I did, I realized how much it could really help my game.
Totally.
And I keep on getting to this point where like I feel like I get really good. And then I kind of meet my max, like I hit my ceiling for how good I can get with that swing I have, with everything I'm doing. I go and tinker a little bit and I come back and it's kind of like I take 2 steps forward, 1 step back. And I'm still in that process of taking 2 steps forward and coming 1 step back. Like this year was a really big year for me, but I still felt like I had points this season where I took that 1 step back. So like I want to keep tweaking and finding what I think is, you know, perfect, which you'll never find in golf. But how do you balance that, right? Like how do you balance the wanting to get better, putting in the work, but then also realizing like, okay, yeah, your driving is good enough. Your putting is good enough. Here's what you have to work at next. Like to your point, the room for error gets so small. We're talking about half shots and strokes on your average over 50 rounds or 100 rounds a year, whatever it is. How do you balance that? Like, what do you tell your folks that you coach?
Yeah, I think that's hard, right? And that's the stuff that can get you going down the wrong path if you go too far one way or the other that you don't need to, right? And I've done it. My college teammates, my buddies know that, like, I have a lot of putters sitting in the basement, right? And it's like, you know, because the one in the basement always is keeping the eye on the one in the bag, right? Because the one in the bag stops behaving.
Gotta hold them accountable, man.
Of course.
Gotta hold them accountable. Of course.
And
sure.
I'm like, I'm an equipment nerd. So like, I love that stuff. So it's like, it's been a learning process, but I'm like, all right, I'm going to stick with stuff that I know fits and I know is good and like all that. But I think, being able to, and it kind of ties back to what you're talking about with the decade stuff or keeping your stats. Like, I think it's evaluating your performance, like unemotionally almost, of like, okay, I know what I think I don't do well or what I think I do well, but like, what do the stats tell me? Like what do, if I'm keeping good stats or if my coach is keeping good stats or whatever, like finding what you need to work on objectively of like, all right, like admittedly like for me, the one big thing over the last year and a half or so has been like, I've always been a streaky putter, I guess would be a good, like when it's good, it's really good. When it's off, it's like, that's why we have 6 putters in the basement.
Hold on. What does a guy of your, and can I, what is your hand? Like, you keep a handicap?
No.
If you had to guess, what is it?
Plus probably 4 or 5, plus something four or like five. That.
Yeah. Yeah, so we're talking about somebody that like in today's terms would probably be considered an extremely elite college player or somebody that's like playing professionally, like make it professionally. Like that's a,
yeah,
you're a highly skilled golfer. How do you, what do you think is bad putting? Is bad putting like when you're tracking your stats, mm-hmm. right? What is, are you looking at make rates between 5 and 20 feet? Are you talking about anti-3 putt? And
that's, for me, it was speed. It was okay. Speed, it was speed control, where like if I would, for just an example is like, okay, the last 2023 at our Minnesota section PGA championship, the one that qualifies us for the national one, was up at, Fortune Bay at Wilderness,
okay.
up there, way up north. Awesome. Super awesome golf course. I had never been there actually. So played the practice round, 2-day event. The final round, so I shot 69 the first round. So I was in the second to last group going into the second day. And on the front nine that day, I three putted three times. And that was all didn't miss shorties. It was just all speed related. I would either leave it, you know, if I
trying to be fair to yourself, were they like super tucked pins and kind of like unfair, or they just, they were difficult, but nothing
there,
that
there was one putt that was like, I had like a 70 footer. So like statistically, I'm probably going to three putt that.
Yeah.
X times out of 10. Whatever.
But the other ones were
kind of silly, like 25 footers that I either blow 6 feet by or leave 5 feet short, whatever. And then I ended up in a playoff for the last spot to go to nationals and lost the playoff. So like
you're looking back like, man, just one of those 25 footers.
That's what it was. It's rarely ever, oh, I need to make more birdies. And it's usually always like, let's clean up the mistakes kind of thing. Like,
yeah.
Okay. Let's just try not to, it's so easy to say like, oh, let's just not three putt. So that's a way to, you know, we're talking about how do we get comfortable being, you know, lower than our expected average, right? Of how do we, if I'm four under, how do I stay four under? How do I take it to five or six under? If I'm, you know, if you're trying to break 80 for the first time, it's like, all right, I'm six over with two to go. Like, how do I, let's steer this thing into the house, right?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that is recognizing, one starts with recognizing your patterns of what do you do? And if under pressure, I think being able to talk to yourself of being like, all right, under pressure, I know that, or that's where having a good instructor would help too. It's like,
yeah,
when I'm nervous, I tend to do X. So for me, when I'm nervous, I tend to hit putts too hard. I know that myself. Or if you struggle to get off the tee under pressure, it's like, okay, I know when I'm really nervous, I tend to try to hold that face open and guide it. And it goes high, right. Or what, you know, whatever your miss is,
sure.
Yeah. Like being able to diagnose that and then doing like everything possible to like build a game again, almost against that a little bit.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, people's, a lot of times you hear about pros being able to hit like the nine shots, right? You're like low fade, high fade, low draw, high draw, straight, all that stuff. Most pros don't actually do that.
Yeah. They probably don't need to.
They don't need to. And I'll know for sure that a lot of club golfers don't need to do that. Right. Yeah. It's like, okay, if I want, you know, if you want to hit a draw or fade off the tee, like let's try to do that every single time.
Yeah. The Bryson method, just hit like the same drive
totally.
Every single time, get super comfortable with it.
And that's make it like boring golf is so good. Right. It's like there's a little bit like of a, you know, sometimes it's kind of like a vanity thing of like, oh, I want to hit the high flop shot. Like, I want to see if I can do this. Well, it's like, well,
you should never need to hit a high flop shot.
Yeah, right.
Shot,
it's like,
right?
You probably don't need to do that, but.
Well, and if you're just hitting regular shots, you're probably not in a position where you have to hit a high flop. Like, you're only having to hit a high flop shot if you're like really out of position,
totally.
Short sighted.
It's an outlier. And,
like,
yeah. Yep. It's an outlier shot. And so I think like just a lot of it, I think that's honestly why Scott and Decade has had such success is like, that's kind of the answer for a lot of people is like, yeah, we need to
having a strategy.
We need to pick better targets. We need to like, unless there is a cross hazard or something like, sure, go ahead. And for most people are more accurate with their driver than they are with their three wood anyway, you know, or if it's like how many times, like you feel so dumb if you're like, oh, I'm going to be smart and hit an iron off this tee. And then you miss the fairway anyway. It's like, well, that's stupid. Like I should have just hit driver and I'm probably going to be okay up there anyway.
Yeah.
So like, that stuff and understanding, I start almost every putting clinic or putting lesson I give with I ask them, I said, what do you think, you know, blank footage, your PGA Tour or LPGA Tour players make 50% from blank feet? And I said, what do you think that number is? And most, you know, 15, 20 feet, 18, something like that. It's like, well, what if I told you it was 8 feet? 2 inches. And they go, whoa.
Yeah. Okay. That's like, you know, that putting mat right there.
Right. And that's where it goes 100%. And that's where it goes back to like almost treat your, I don't know if you follow John Sherman. He's another kind of course management guy. He's on Twitter, X or whatever.
I don't know that name.
But he, No Laying Up just did a really good video with him. He kind of, I don't know if he coined it, but I saw him use it where he thinks of lag putts almost as approach putts where like, you're not necessarily trying to, like, yes,
you're trying to get it in a circle.
You would love if it went in, obviously.
Yeah.
But like, you're like, all right, I'm 35 feet. Like statistically, I'm probably not going to make that many of these. Like, let's just get it up. You know, almost the 10% rule is something I like, where if you're 30 feet away, you look at a 3 foot circle. If you're 40 feet away, I look at a 4 foot circle. So 10% of whatever
I like that.
So like 10% of whatever the footage is would be like your acceptable range.
Yeah.
And that's something that's like, oh, that one, it takes pressure off you a little bit too. Cause like you don't have to be perfect. And it's then it's breaking down, especially when we're talking putting, and we could talk putting all day because it's been my nemesis.
Oh, yeah.
But shout out to Lab because that saved my...
Oh, we'll talk about that
saved,
too.
Saved my putting game
this year. I got three Lab putters yes, in here now.
But I'm a full believer. But the, you know, basically priority ranking, like, okay, what are the three main characteristics of putting? You have being able to start the ball online, reading the green correctly, and having proper pace, speed control. And outside of, say, 4 or 5 feet, it's, I would say, green reading the most important thing. Speed, you know, green reading and speed control would be 1 and 1A, essentially, and then start line would be third.
Wow, start line's third, huh?
Well, just like...
Wouldn't start line... I guess start line probably goes hand in hand with green reading, right?
Like, yeah, and because, like, if you think about, like, take aim point, for example, like a green reading method that people on tour have been adopting, it's... I think it's very useful if you learn how to do it correctly. Most PGA Tour, so take Max Homa, for instance. I would wager that he could probably start the golf ball online pretty well.
Yeah, he's probably
right?
Pretty good.
He probably can roll the ball where he's looking. I imagine he has pretty good pace control. He took his game to another level when he started reading the greens better, when he started using aim point. And then he won, I don't know what he won, 3 times last year or 2 years ago, whatever it was. So like, it'd be like giving you the keys to a Ferrari and then asking you to drive to my house. Well, you're like, well, I don't know where you live. So it's like, all right, cool. You would have a supercar or whatever, but if you're not aiming that thing correctly, or, you know, if you don't have the roadmap, exactly. So I would say get, you know, speed control, which I mean, Decade preaches ad nauseum, right? And then
every good putting instructor, coach, person I've talked about putting, that's what they all say.
Well,
so
speed
if people haven't
line.
Figured it out now, yeah. it's putting is all speed.
Totally. Because that determines line as well, right? So, and it effectively makes the hole bigger because if you're, you know, if you're ramming it at the hole and it hits the lip, there's no chance it's going in, but if it's more die speed. So I think that's a big thing that people can improve on. And you can do that. And, you know, you can do that in the winter too. There's plenty of drills for stuff like that. But, we have to get creative here in Minnesota when we're stuck inside
Do you guys have anything at Yacht Club that you practice on or in, like indoors?
Yeah, we have two TrackMan simulators. So we'll set those up kind of mid-November, but which is a great time to do some like technical changes if you need to, you know, if you have a plan to do that over the winter or over the off season, because it doesn't necessarily matter at that point where the golf ball's going. You know, you've got 4 months to work on something or try to ingrain a change. But one thing I would say personally, I use our simulators more than anything is basically 120 yards and in is try to get a wedge. Cause I, even though our simulators or whatever this is like 15, you know, say it's 15 feet wide. Like I always feel so claustrophobic hitting drivers inside in the winter. I just like, I know I'm not going to hit the edge, you know, the sides.
Yeah, but
it just
feels like you might. And if you do, it feels really bad
weird
for
everyone. Yeah. And it's embarrassing. But, so I will hit, I would say I do more wedge practice in the winter than anything of like, all right, cool. Like, cause TrackMan or Foresight or FlightScope or whatever technology you use, they're so good now that you know exactly how far the ball's going, you know exactly how much it's spinning, and what an awesome time to get your carry numbers dialed in.
Yeah, right? It's funny you say that. I'm curious now just from like an instructional standpoint. I mean, I'd obviously research like everything out there and watch all the YouTube videos and do all of it. And, you know, even John said like, you know, his advice to any amateur was if you had an hour, 3 days a week, 45 minutes of that would just be on wedges, like 150 yards and in.
For sure. Yeah.
Cause that's where those are the scoring clubs. Those are, you know, you shouldn't be making bogey from that number, especially if like, even for single digit handicaps, like you got to find a way to not make bogey from 150 and in, like you're usually pitching wedges or less. So like get really good at those numbers. I'm curious how much of like, call it that wedge swing or those swings translate into those 4, 5 and 6 irons. Because like when I look at my stats, those are the two things I need to get better at, wedges and then over 200 green and reg. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to figure out a way to like check those things out the box. And a lot of instructional videos that I watch will say like the wedge swings will translate into the longer iron swings. Cause it's easier to make the changes with shorter clubs.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, that's 100% accurate. And you just tend to have more of those throughout a round anyway. So you might as well practice with an 8 iron or a 9 iron. Cause you just tend to have more of them than 4 irons. I would say for the long irons, one, it's like, do everything possible to just make sure you're trying to make good contact. Right. And then from there, it's like, I think a little bit of expectation management, because it's, you know, if I have a 5-iron and say, you know, say I'm 200 yards away, and that's kind of in between a 6 and a 5 for me, but it's like anywhere on the green from 200 yards is an awesome golf shot.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, I don't know exactly what the number is offhand, but from 190 yards on tour, it's like 35 feet. It's like, sweet. That's great. So like, I think, and it kind of goes back to, if you make 3 on every par 3 forever, you're going to be gaining an infinite amount of shots on the people you're playing against. Right.
Well, especially because the level, the better you get, the longer those par 3s are. Right. Yeah. Like if you're playing from most blue, like 6,800 yard golf courses, you don't have par 3s that are less than 150, like very rarely. Right. Do you, unless they're front pins or something wonky for the day, but they're mostly 7 irons or more.
Yeah, totally. And then now, and I mean, I'm just like, just think about Windsong. It's like, all right, you've got a couple pretty beefy par threes, and even number 7 from the back tee is what, like one
hole seven
is that the, like 175 or so?
Well, 170? So hole 7 plays the hardest of all the holes on the course to par, in all of the actual tournaments that we do, like in the Gopher Invitational, it's always the hardest.
Cause that's kind of what I was getting at too. Yeah.
I think from the back tee, it's like 190 yard shot, but it's playing down 10 to 12. It's a relatively small green. Wind is almost always off the right.
Yep.
And then everything moves left to right on the green. Yep. So it's just got a lot of things going against it.
Yep. And you're staring at the water, and then if you bail out of it, there's a bunker there.
And the middle of the green is actually the tightest. It goes kind of short in the front, and then it kind of comes in kind of like an hourglass and then back out. And then to your point, that middle part of the green that a lot of people would want to aim at, bunker right to your left, obviously water to your
nowhere to bail out, and you might have a 7 or 8 iron in your hand, and all of a sudden you're more nervous than if you had a 5 iron.
If it's a front pin, like now you're hitting to a small part of the green. If it's a back pin, you know, that's kind of where you want it, but you still got to carry it all the way there. And if it's a middle pin, it's the tightest part of the green.
Totally.
So it's just, it's a hard golf shot.
Yeah. So I think the, you know, kind of wrapping the long iron thing would be like, yes, your swing with the shorter irons should translate a bit, because the technique probably won't change that much. I would say the biggest technical change would just being making sure that your setup is consistent on the longer shots, like on the longer irons, and just those subtle tweaks of like, all right, if I have, say your ball position's center for an 8 iron or whatever, you know, or a 9 iron or something, maybe it's a ball or two forward of that for a 5 iron, you know, just because you're not trying to hit down on it as much. You're going to try to get it in the air a little bit more. So those subtle setup tweaks are going to be pretty important as you get longer, and making sure that the longer the club, making sure that your tempo stays consistent, just because it's physically a longer stick. So it's going to be harder to get from the top of the backswing down to the ball squarely in a consistent fashion. Yeah, right.
Naturally.
So, and then also they're like, all right, let's try to get contact as tight as we can get with the long irons. Going back to try to have a consistent ball flight if you can, right? As somebody who cuts the ball, I would much rather overcut it than hit a pull.
Yeah,
right? 100%. Nothing scares me more than the ball going left, right? Yeah. So, and for a drawer, maybe it's, you know, you'd rather overdraw it than hit the high right one. But so like that would be, and then it's just like, hey, if I have a 5 iron in my hand, like, let's just get it anywhere on the green. I'm skipping up there and being happy, right?
Yeah.
So you're probably not going to make that many birdies, right? From like 200, you know, it's like, I'm not trying to make birdie from 200 yards.
Yeah, I'm just trying not to make bogey.
Yeah. Or just like, all right, take the flag off the green. If I just, you know, if I aim right at the center of the green, you hopefully have a variance of, you know, this is my leftmost miss, this would be my rightmost missed, and going back to more decade stuff, let's try to center that as best we can. But then with the wedges, it's like, all right, cool. Now I have an opportunity. Maybe we can get a little bit more aggressive. Yeah. Right. You know, I'm picking good targets, but like, let's try to just kind of inch it more toward the flag.
Well, and then, so from you have all that, and then you have like the mental aspect of golf, which we talk about a decent amount on here. And, I think is probably something that most golfers this off season, and myself included, need to spend more time on. And like the decade stuff, course management, all that is one thing. But then there's also like the proverbial, like, oh, I hit it better on the range than I do on the course. There's always the, you know, oh, I felt like, you know, leading up to the round, I was like feeling good and everything. And then I get on hole one and make a triple bogey. I see you talk a lot about process, and that's a lot of, you know, what like a lot of top golfers you hear them talk about on TV. Like, what are some of the mental things that, you know, people can kind of work out on in the off season? Like, this is a big topic of discussion for a lot of people. My buddy, Michael Leonard, Mr. Wicked Smart, he talks about process, creating a good pre-shot routine, not spending too much time over the ball. Like, what are some of the things that you think about, you know, when you're heading into tournaments? Like, what's the kind of mental part of it?
I think the mental stuff, and again, this has been a big kind of investigative process for me, because that was the part that I always struggled with too, is get super nervous, get ahead of yourself when you're on turn. It's like, oh, if I just
par the last four, five holes. Yeah,
exactly. So that's, and I'm, you know, obviously not the only one that thinks that way. And it's, I think that's where I think this year specifically, like telling myself, like, I just want to get uncomfortable as much as I possibly can. Whatever happens, I'm probably going to learn from it either way. Right. And which is like, no, I don't want to like spectacularly fail when I'm in contention. Like, of course not. Yeah. But that's where you have to go back of like, how prepared was I for this event? Right. It's spending, you know, I always kind of think about it as like, all right, if I have a wedge that I'm really nervous about on the 18th, you know, say third shot into 18 at Windsong or something, if I have 100 yards, it's like, how many successful 100 yard shots have I hit in my life? Like, probably a lot. Right. So like, you have that kind of Rolodex to fall back on of like, okay, I've done this a number of times. I know how far my club goes, like that kind of thing. Like, all right, you've done it a ton. This is no different than all of those. Trying to like almost trick yourself into thinking like, yeah, I've done this a ton.
Yeah.
But one thing I think that's really helped me that I talked to a lot of like some of my high school players about, especially ones that are like, oh, I don't know if I'm good enough to go to state, or if I'm starting college in the fall, like, ah, I'm nervous, like whatever. It's like, well, obviously you're good enough to make your varsity team. So like, you're good enough to play in the state tournament, or one girl this summer was really nervous about starting college golf. And I was like, well, you know, they recruited you and you committed, and like, obviously, like, you're clearly good enough. So like, take that confidence. You don't need to be somebody you're not, right? How often do we play with somebody who's really good or better than us, and you try to all of a sudden like swing like them, or try, yeah, they hit it further than you, and you're like, oh, I gotta kind of step on this one. Right. I think in tournaments, one thing that's really helped me is constantly reminding myself to just be where your feet are, is like a saying that I kind of really, really like, of just like, okay, just, I can't be three holes ahead now. Right. I can only be right here. Right. So just be where your feet are. And then every, you know, golf's a game of, you know, every shot is a new independent decision.
Yeah.
Right. And all you can do is the one that's at hand. Right. So it's just like, all right, let's snap back into right where we are. I can't think like, oh, I need to go two under the last four to make the cut at the state open or what, you know, whatever. It's like, no, all you can do is just be right here. Let's kind of almost like get external of like, all right, think about, you know, what's the wind doing? What's all this stuff, instead of being like, oh, I have to do this in order, or I've got a par five coming up that I really want to birdie, but I just have to get through this hole first.
I do, and this
like,
all the time.
Right.
Yeah. So I think every golfer does it.
We all do because it's so easy to just look ahead of like, all right, I need to do this in order for this to happen coming up, which is just not the way golf works. Right. So it's be where your feet are. All you can do is the shot at hand. That's where having a pre-shot routine that's consistent, and somewhat of a post-shot routine too, of like, all right, how do I decompress so I don't take either a good shot or bad shot with me to the next one, and then just restart the process again. Like, have those, make another good independent decision. And at the end of the day, it's like, all right, if I made 18 holes worth of sound decisions,
72 really good decisions,
then it's probably going to work out okay, right? Because like, a lot of people are physically, they can swing the golf club better than they score a lot of times.
100%. Right?
And it's like, okay, where's the missing link? And it's like, it's probably something little and kind of dumb like that, where it's like, yeah, it's like, be where your feet are. That's kind of a weird saying, but it's like, well, it kind of works depending on, you know, what your mental aptitude is how strong you are.
Yeah. Well, it's just kind of funny because I think in a lot of other sports, you're looking at strategy and you're looking at things that aren't, like, golf's really one of the only sports that's like that, right? Like, there's a lot of other sports that people typically grow up playing. And I think that's why golf ends up being something that we all get addicted to, or like, you know, the golf nuts out there know, like, there's just something about the sport. And that's probably one of the big things, which is like the course is like what Scott Fawcett said, like the course is perfect for the day, right? Like it's the perfect opponent. It doesn't make any dumb decisions. Nope. It's already there.
It's right there.
Right. Like, so you have to play perfect against it in order to beat it. And if you don't, it's gonna punish you. Yep. And I think that's like what makes it so beautiful, but also frustrating in the same realm.
And what's crazy is you don't even have to be perfect either to like shoot a score that you're pleased with. Right. Like, I mean, you know, I think so like the lowest, I shot the lowest. I tied my career low in a tournament this year, which was awesome, but it's like, that's a round I made two bogeys in that round. Right. So it's, I didn't have to. People think about like going back to like being the scuba diver thing of going deep. It's like, you certainly don't have to be perfect on, you know, to shoot your lowest round of your life or whatever. You don't have to never miss a shot. And that's not possible. Nobody's going to never miss a shot. Right. I think that's where, one of my college coaches who was a really good player, the only golf balls he kept, like, you know, as like mementos or whatever, were bogey free rounds. So like
how many did he have? Like, I still don't have
like
one.
Kind of like a spooky amount, really? Which was weird. He had this little like shag bag in the back of his trunk. There was probably 20, 25 golf balls in there,
pretty good.
Which I'm like, bogey. And then the more you think about it, I'm like, wow, that's like really impressive. Yeah. Right. And cause then you're like, I don't know that I had a bogey free round this year.
I still have one. It's kind of one of those things I've been tracking. I got through 12 holes the other day, and it's actually really funny because at the turn I thought about it, and then I made a bogey like two or three holes later.
You just let it in and then it's right.
Yeah, I did. I looked, I was like, oh man, you know, and it wasn't like a overly hard course. You're down in Arizona but still bogey free is bogey free.
And
like literally the second I thought about it, I made a fuck bogey.
Yep. Right.
And it's that's wild how it works.
It's crazy.
But too.
Yeah. And it's like, oh yeah. Like I said, it was the lowest scoring average of my life this year. And I didn't have a single bogey free round. So it's like, all right, you don't have to be. And that's where being accepting that bad shots are going to come and being able to have the mental strength to handle them and to adjust course a little bit of like, and like you said, when you were at the Yacht Club for a scratch match, it's like you had no expectations going into that round. Right. And it's, you know, cause a lot of times when you have a good warm up or something, you're like, oh, I'm flushing it. Like this could be kind of good, you know? And then you get out there and all of a sudden you have no idea where the club is. It's like, okay, now we're grinding to break 80 or whatever it is, you know,
it's going to be one of those.
And that's why this is the most complicated, simple game in the world. And it keeps us hooked. But
well, to kind of wrap up, we're going into winter. Obviously you're going to be coaching and teaching people, you know, what are the things that you're kind of focusing on, I guess, as an instructor? Like, what are people coming to you about right now? Like what kind of off-season program do you preach to the folks that you see?
Yeah, I think, the people that I've seen or can kind of have been seeing for a while now, it's a lot of keeping up what we've been working on. Just cause you're inside doesn't mean you can't keep, you know, grinding away at the same stuff we were doing outside. Obviously the scoring stuff is a little different cause we're not on the golf course. But, I think a big part of that's kind of evolved in my teaching is I've, am currently continuing to go through the TPI stuff, the fitness stuff with the Titleist Performance Institute. So really getting people, and it becomes such a big believer in that as I've been going through it, of you can't make somebody try to do something that their body can't do. Right. And it starts with that. And they do a big thing in there of like, okay, your three things that people typically struggle with, or is it a body problem? Is it a technique problem, or is it an equipment problem? And that kind of goes back to our fitting thing, right? Yeah. Of like most swing faults or bad golf can be dissected down into one of those three things. Right. And so being able to, and something I love watching other good teachers teach and podcasts and YouTube, I can get on the deep dives of all that stuff, but it's, really trying to integrate that more into my teaching. And then, for call it beginners or people I haven't seen, like what a great time to work on stuff for the next 4 months where we don't really care where the ball goes. We can kind of, you know, when we're in the summer, it's like, hey, let's get you to the point where you can go out and try to make a score. A lot of short game, a lot of that stuff. But in the wintertime, it's like, yeah, we can take a slower approach. We can try to break stuff down and as we need to and build it back up. So we're ready to hit the ground running.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll have to come see you this winter and we can look at my swing too.
Come hang out. It's all good.
For sure. I appreciate you coming on, talking really all things.
Yeah, of course.
I really appreciate it. Hopefully we get to play together next year if you're going to be doing the scratch golf thing, but we should play.
Let's plan on it.
Yeah, we should plan on it. And I think I'm going to try and play. I want to do the mid-am. I want to do the, I want to at least try and qualify for maybe the state open or something like that, play some more qualifiers. And then, I think I'm going to do the, probably the four ball, next year as well. Maybe find a partner and do that. I've got a buddy that was pro that is, going to be an am now and might be a good partner to play with. So try and play some more tournament golf.
Love
it. Just get to that next level.
Throw yourself in the mix. See what happens.
Yeah. Try and get comfortable with being uncomfortable.
That's right. I love it.
Yeah. I appreciate you coming on, man. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.